Maybe you had him as a professor at Fresno State, or perhaps more recently, he's guided you on a tour of Fresno's Chaffee Zoo. Today on Hometown Heroes, this 90-year-old veteran remembers flying B-17s in World War II.
Loaded with fuel and bombs, you just hoped that the bird would fly.
Hear his story on Hometown Heroes today at 1 on News Talk 580 or 5 p.m. on FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ. Each week we visit with veterans of World War II. The idea is to let them know how much we appreciate them, to make sure they're honored for their service and their sacrifice, that their stories are preserved for posterity so we don't lose these important pieces of history. Each week we get a personal glimpse into this tumultuous time in world history. And I know we're going to learn a lot today because our guest is a former Fresno State professor. Maybe you had him in a class, a history class at Fresno State. He taught there for 21 years. 90-year-old Jim Eccles, our guest today. We're going to talk about his time flying B-17s with the 97th Bomb Group. But let's go back earlier than that, Jim, if we can. You grew up in Iowa, correct?
Yes, Sioux City.
Sioux City, Iowa. What was that like before World War II?
It was rural, actually. I was in a city of, some 70,000, I guess, but we felt like we were rural folk.
Now, you're 90 years old now, which tells me when Pearl Harbor happened, you would have been maybe just out of high school, huh?
I had 1 year of college in 1940-41.
Where was that?
In Sioux City.
Right there in Sioux City.
Morningside College.
And when December 7th, 1941 rolled around, how did you find out about what had happened?
Well, by that time, I had migrated to Southern California.
That's quite a move.
Yeah, it was. a buddy of mine from school and I decided that we would try for jobs at in the aircraft industry. We went out to L.A. and I was hired the first day I got there at Lockheed, building
P-38s. How long did you work there before Pearl Harbor happened?
Well, I started there in August, and in December, Pearl Harbor came along.
Do you remember when you heard about it, what
yes,
it felt
I
like?
Yes, I do. I was alone watching a movie in Pasadena, and the first inkling I had of it was they stopped the movie and flashed a slide on the screen as saying that all service personnel should report to their bases.
Mm-hmm.
Then resumed the movie. And when I got outside, the extra editions of the newspaper were all over the streets.
Did it hit you at the time? Did it register to you that the world was changing, that your life was going to change?
Immediately and powerfully. I knew the next day that I was going to be drafted shortly.
Well, and I know you did something about that, but before we move on from this time in your personal history, working down there for Lockheed at the P-38 plant, I imagine some folks would want to know what you were doing there at the plant, what your specific duties were in the assembly of these magnificent airplanes.
Well, actually, I wasn't at the main plant. I worked at a sub-assembly plant in downtown Los Angeles.
All right.
7th and Santa Fe on the Los Angeles riverbanks. It was an old Ford plant which had been empty throughout the Depression, and Lockheed had leased it to build outer wings and other sub-assemblies for the P-38. And I was living in Pasadena with the friend that I came out with because he had a sister living there.
Mm-hmm.
I was lucky enough to get in a carpool and working the swing shift, so I had a ride to work and back every day. And that first night after Pearl Harbor, we started our shift, and shortly after it, all the lights went out. In fact, the whole city was blacked out.
Mm-hmm.
And there were reports of Japanese planes and bombings, which I guess turned out all to be false. But we were evacuated, spent the night in the parking lot till our shift was over.
I would imagine that would get your attention just
yes,
a little bit.
Yes, it did.
So had you had a desire to fly before this? Had that been something that was in the back of your mind?
Oh, yeah. I had only been up in an airplane once before. Small biplane at a little rinky-dink airport outside of Sioux City. But it grabbed me.
Mm-hmm.
And I always had the thought of flying. And then the friend that I went to California with and his brother were also close friends, and the three of us all enlisted together.
Mm-hmm. How soon after Pearl Harbor did you do that?
In April.
Okay. And I'm picturing you here working at this aircraft plant and assembling these P-38 wings and daydreaming about flying a P-38. Is that a fair assumption to make?
Yeah, that was the picture.
And so when you enlisted with the idea of becoming a pilot, right?
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of guys did that. Just about everyone I've ever talked to who went into the Air Corps wanted to be a pilot. It made it a pretty competitive thing.
It was. When we were going through the assignment process, selection process, and some were being assigned to flight school, some to navigation school, some to bombardier school, and we all hoped we'd get to be pilots.
And what was that like for you, the training process, the education process? I mean, it's pretty involved to get that kind of duty, I would
say. It was a lot of training, yeah. From the time I was, I was actually called up, told to report to Union Station in Los Angeles in April, took us on a troop train out to Texas. That's where my training started. There was a backlog at that time, that part of the war, when pilot recruits.
Mm-hmm.
So they set up a program where future cadets were sent for college training. I was fascinated by the courses they gave us in meteorology and radio code and astronomy. Then they jerked us out of there and sent us to basic training, just plain old infantry basic training. And then on to cadet training, starting with pre-flight at Santa Ana. And from there, pre-flight to primary, which was in Tucson, Arizona, and basic down at Bakersfield, Minter Field, which was my first view of the Central Valley, introduction to it. And then,
did it remind you of Iowa?
Not at all. seeing the mountains from the airfield and this flat valley was a totally thrilling experience, actually.
Especially from the air, I'm sure. And did you have in your mind an idea of what kind of planes you wanted to fly?
We all wanted fighters, but that wasn't possible. So.
I've heard, it's amazing, and every story is different, but it's amazing. Everybody I've ever talked to who signed up for the Air Corps wanted to be a pilot, and every one of those wanted to be a fighter pilot. Nobody
exactly.
got in to fly bombers. But it turns out those bombers were pretty good to you.
Well, we had to settle for them, and we're happy with it.
Do you remember the first time you saw a B-17? I'm sure you remember.
No.
The first time you flew one.
Maybe the first time I saw one was when I was in primary training down at Bakersfield Field. Every day we'd fly, a group of us would fly out to Satellite Field and takeoffs and landings from there. So a bunch of us were just sitting around that airstrip one day when other cadets were flying, and looked up, and here came a great huge four-engine plane right toward us, and it buzzed the field not more than 50 feet over us and went off. And we assume that's probably some pilot who's just gotten his wings and went through primary at Mitter Field. Showing off.
Showing off and getting your attention, that's for sure. The first time that you actually got up to go in and fly one of those, was it intimidating to have that big of a craft at your controls and have that kind of responsibility?
Well, no, because I was just a co-pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And that was at Kingman, Arizona.
Okay.
After I'd gotten my wings and commission, I was sent to co-pilot school, which was in Kingman, Arizona, and it was actually a gunnery school for gunners. The pilots were all veterans who had come back from England and flew gunnery flights, target flights for target practice, also ground targets. And so we just flew with them and learned the plane as they did their target flying.
And I bet they had some good stories to tell from that early air war in Europe.
They did, yeah. They were glamorous to us.
That was going to be my next question. Did that make you more eager to get over there or less, hearing their stories?
Not really. I think they tried to scare us with some of their stories. And it made us a little bit unsure what we were getting into.
Mm-hmm. So you weren't one of those who was just chomping at the bit, ready to head overseas?
I didn't know anyone who was.
Yeah? Heard too many of those stories.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take our first commercial break of the program. When we come back, we're going to hear about some of the 22 missions that Jim Echols flew in B-17s as a co-pilot serving in the 97th Bomb Group during World War II. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on KMJ. After a down-to-the-wire Bulldog game, there's nothing quite like throwing yourself onto a comfortable bed. Paul Leffler here. You know, I heard my buddy Ray Ocanto talking about his mattress on the radio, and I thought, wait just a second. Wait till I tell you about the one my wife and I found at Sleep Retreat. Sleep Retreat is Fresno's only premium bedding store on El Paso, right next to Fashion Furniture. I heard Ray use the word comfort, but I can't imagine any bed being more comfortable than the Tempur-Pedic Cloud Lux we're sleeping on. It's soft where you want it to be soft, firm where you want it to be firm, and if you really want the long and short of it, it doesn't matter if your legs are long or short. My wife Tanya's about 5'1 and petite. I'm 6'3 and not so petite. But that oh-so-comfortable Tempur-Pedic mattress fits us both like a glove. I guess I should have seen it coming. After all, Tempur-Pedic invented memory foam. Tempur-Pedic is the most recommended sleep surface in America. And nobody in Central California knows Tempur-Pedic better than the fine folks at Sleep Retreat on El Paso next to Fashion Furniture.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We are visiting today with a U.S. Army Air Corps veteran of World War II. He served with the 97th Bomb Group, flying 22 missions as a co-pilot on B-17 Flying Fortresses. When we left off, Jim Eccles had given us a little bit of his first impression of the B-17 all the way through training. And you said, Jim, that you weren't eager to get overseas. When that moment came and you found out, here you were heading over, what do you remember? How would you describe your mindset? What was going through your head at the time?
Oh, by that time, we were over the earlier uncertainty about what we were facing. We knew pretty well what we were getting into. So we were just looked at it as a job we had to do.
Give us a taste of some of the things you had heard, because obviously there's newspapers, there's the newsreels, there's radio reports constantly, and you're getting some decent updates about what the B-17s and all these bomb groups are doing over there in Europe. What kind of things had you heard?
I guess we had two sources, actually, information. The press and radio was our chief source of news, and all the networks and services were full of it. The other source was from the instructors who had returned from doing their tour duty and were now instructor pilots wherever we ran into them. And so we had heard pretty much a straight story on what we were getting into.
You had heard about the number of B-17s that have been shot down? For instance, the first Ploesti raid comes to mind?
Yeah, exactly. But the nearer we got to going overseas, the further past the difficult times like Ploesti were over, and it was just routine bombing of our targets in southern Germany and Austria.
From your base in Italy.
And yes.
Let's talk about heading over. I imagine you had formed some good friendships with some of the guys you trained with. Were you hoping that you'd be able to fly with the crew you'd trained with?
Well, we knew that we expected that we would. We had been together for 6 or 8 weeks training together out of Dyersburg Air Force Base in Tennessee before we headed, went from there to Lincoln, Nebraska, were assigned a plane and headed off toward Labrador and Newfoundland, the Azores, and North Africa to reach Italy. That was a big adventure because for the first time we were not under total command of somebody else. We were on our own, really, along with other planes that were flying along with us. But we were in command of our plane, and that was a wonderful feeling.
Going over there and knowing everything that had already happened in this war and not knowing how long this war was going to go on or what was going to happen in it, did you feel confident that you'd be coming back, or did you have that concern that you might not make it home?
You know, I knew a few guys, mostly enlisted men, who talked about not coming back. But by and large, we all felt that we were going to make it through this war. The only question was, are we going to return having completed our missions, or were we going to be there at the end of the war?
You're thinking, I fly 25 missions, I'll make it home, or even better, the war will end before I get there.
Yeah, right.
Tell me about the area where you guys were based, and give us a sense, too, if you can, the timeline of when you arrived there and what you found.
Okay. The 15th Air Force was based near Foggia, Italy, which is right at the spur of the boot of the peninsula. The 15th had been formed out of the 8th Air Force in England at the time of the North African invasion. Mm-hmm. And so it supported the invasion in Morocco, Algeria, and then moved across North Africa as the Allied forces advanced up to Tunis and jumped to Sicily and then to southern Italy. Took over a complex of airstrips in the flat plain which existed between the mountains, the Apennines, and the promontory, which is a mountain range forming the spur of the boot.
Mm-hmm.
So there were dozens of airstrips in this valley, all of which had been built by the Germans and which we took over Most of the airstrips were made up of metal steel runway flat pieces that linked together to form an airstrip.
Right.
Interestingly, this area reminded me much of the Central Valley, what little I had seen of it during primary. A flat area with the mountains in the distance, snow-covered during the winter. The climate almost exactly like Fresno.
Mm-hmm. You got there when? In fall of 44?
September of 44. Flew my first mission in October.
What do you remember about that first mission? Did you have the proverbial butterflies in the stomach?
Strangely enough, I don't have any memory of it. I'd have to look back at my log.
And you still have your log, and you also have some wonderful color photos. And it's rare to have color photos from World War II that the serviceman himself actually took. And Jim has some tremendous photos. I'll put some of them online at kmjnow.com and also on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Some of those photos have snow. In fact, there's you and your crew having a snowball fight in one of these pictures. I guess you were there for Christmas in 1944,
That's right.
What do you remember about that?
We did some celebrating, and we had an officers' club. I guess I mentioned about our quarters were in an olive grove, much like you'd see an olive grove here in the valley. We took over the farm buildings and made them our headquarters, and then we billeted in tents, which accommodated four officers. I think the enlisted men were more crowded than that. And these tents had been kind of winterized and weatherproofed by earlier crews that had passed through. Some of them were boarded up on the sides, and some of them had sides built of tufa rock, which is a soft stone that's found in the area. Mm-hmm. And you can actually cut it with machetes and shape it into blocks and build with it. The officers' club was a building that we actually built out of tufa rock. It had been built before I arrived there. We had a fireplace, tables, and some sofas. They were in terrible shape, but they served our purpose. We had a Christmas tree that Christmas. We found it. Somebody went up to the woods at the height of the promontory, the spur, and cut a little Christmas tree and brought it down. Don't remember that we even had any decorations for it. We put it on a table in the officers' club, and we partied New Year's Eve on local native wine.
I'm sure it was plentiful in those parts. And did you have much interaction with Italian civilians in the area?
I had more probably than most of my fellow officers. I made a point of studying the language and could speak a little bit of Italian, but found that their dialect was far different from what was in the textbooks I used. But nevertheless, I could communicate a little bit. So when we made trips up to the mountains to get some wood for the fireplace, I tried to do some interpreting and was a total failure at it. But nevertheless, I did have a lot of different contacts with local farmers.
What impression did you get of how they felt about your presence there, about the Americans being there?
They were very grateful and very friendly. Don't recall ever running into hostility any place we went, in the local town or traveling. They were always just out of their way to be friendly to us.
Now, you said that when you went over, it was your expectation that this crew that you'd spent a couple months with training would be the crew you'd fly with, and that's not the way it worked out, huh?
No. When we landed at our home field, a ground crew moved in, took over our airplane, moved our personal effects out of it to our quarters, and we got the feeling immediately, this is no longer our airplane.
Mm-hmm.
It was like taking a toy away from us. Didn't take long for us to gain an understanding of how things worked over there. And we weren't even a crew anymore. We were just experts at our field. We would be moved around with into other crews, and most of the crews on missions were made up of crew members from maybe four or five different crews.
Was that hard for you?
At first, yeah.
Because I would think trust is really important when you've got 10 guys on an airplane and they don't know each other. That could be an issue.
Yeah, it could be. But we got to know the other crew members fast. Flying with them, one mission, you bonded pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't a big problem.
I know we're going to talk about the closest call that you remember, and I'm sure people are going to be on the edge of their seats listening to those hairy details. But can you give us a taste, not that any mission is typical, I'm sure they're all different, but give us a taste of what one of your bombing missions was like from start to finish, how it unfolded through your eyes, and we can see with some of these pictures, too, that you had some time to snap a few photos, even.
A mission started about 3 o'clock in the morning when an enlisted man came around and shook your boot in the sleeping bag and said, it's time to get up. And we went to the huge barn that had been taken over and turned into a briefing room, which was like an auditorium, really.
Or a lecture hall. You might know something about that. Sorry to interrupt.
Without individual seats, they were just benches, a row of benches on each side of the center aisle. And the 10 of us on a crew sat on one bench on the right or left side with the pilot on the aisle and then down the line to the tail gunner on the far left or right. It took about an hour to do a briefing. We had talks from the squadron commander, group commander, on what the mission was, what we were trying to do. We got weather reports from meteorology. We got a briefing from the intelligence officer on what they knew about enemy opposition and the area around the target. And then we were taken on trucks out to the airstrip, which was probably a mile or more away. Each crew member had specific jobs to do. The task of the co-pilot was to pick up from intelligence our escape kits for the entire crew, which were issued when we boarded the plane. And then we checked out our equipment, sat in the plane, and waited for the instructions of the day. There was a lot of bad weather during that winter, just as there is around Fresno during the winter, and so takeoff was an uncertainty. And we had such primitive meteorological information, no satellites.
Mm-hmm.
They flew weather planes up over the target area in the night and radioed back what conditions we could expect. So we sat on the plane and waited for a flare that would tell us we're going to take off or go back to your quarters. We're not flying today.
So as much as they tried to prepare you for everything, they never really could prepare you for everything.
They certainly didn't. They didn't know what to expect most of the time. Everything was an uncertainty.
Now, this was later in the air war in Europe.
Yeah.
Were you still facing fighter opposition, FLAC?
Very little fighter opposition. Most of the German Air Force was grounded or flying up in northern Germany over protecting Germany from the 8th Air Force in England. But there were some fighters. We flew with a wing of B-24s. Well, there were actually three wings of B-24s and one wing of 17s in the 15th Air Force. So when the German fighters did appear, they usually elected to attack 24s rather than us. And we felt grateful for that.
And for people that aren't familiar, explain to us why they would target the B-24s instead of the B-17s.
The B-17 was known during the war as the Flying Fortress.
Mm-hmm.
It was armed much more than the B-24 was. They were all 50 caliber machine guns, mostly in turrets with twin guns. The B-24s were far less able to defend themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is much more to come with our conversation with Jim Eccles. When we come back, I'm going to ask him about that aforementioned hairiest mission of World War II, of the 22 he flew, the one that he remembers as the closest call. We'll be right back with the rest of Hometown Heroes on KMJ. Hey, Bulldog fans, Paul Leffler here, coming to you not as the voice of the dogs, but as a husband and father of two. Ever have a hard time finding a restaurant that's family-friendly, won't set you back a week's pay, and has the kind of food that makes you want to keep coming back? I think I found it. And no, it's not one of those chains. It's one of a kind. Luna's Pizzeria, an Italian restaurant on Pulaski Avenue in Old Town Clovis. The Liberta family's been serving up great, authentic Italian food in the heart of cowboy country for more than 40 years. The pizza dough is made from scratch daily, and so is the bread. You won't forget the bread. I'm a sucker for that bread and the meatballs and the ravioli. And hey, did I say family friendly? How do you top a kid's menu with nothing over $3.95, drink included? I'm not making that up. See for yourself at lunasclovis.com. And while you're there, check out the family meal deals. That's lunasclovis.com or 299-4141. Tell them I sent you. And if you really want to, bring me back some bread. Luna's Pizzeria and Italian Restaurant. You'll love it at Luna's. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, talking today with 90-year-old Jim Eccles of Fresno. If he hadn't made it through World War II, maybe you would have never had him for a class at Fresno State. He taught there for 21 years, so if you're a Bulldog, look back through those yearbooks, look back through your transcripts, and see what kind of grade you got from them. If it wasn't for World War II, he never would have met his wife. That happened just before he headed overseas. And he wouldn't be able to tell us about 22 missions in B-17s with the 97th Bomb Group, including one really close call. But before we get to that, let's continue, Jim. You were telling us about a typical mission. You gave us a really good picture of everything that leads up to the mission. But actually, in flight, how that unfolded on a given day, what do you remember? And how would you share that with us?
We flew probably 500 to 800 planes in a mission. Getting that many planes into formation may sound like no problem, but it's a huge operation. Planes are taking off from possibly a dozen different airstrips and forming up into squadrons and then groups and then wings and then the entire Air Force. All of which has to be precisely spaced and timed out. So once we were ready for takeoff, our squadron would line up on our airstrip. Same thing was happening on a dozen other airstrips. And then on signal, we would roll down the rough old steel runway and bounce into the air, hope we could stay airborne.
Sounds like you felt that takeoff a little bit, huh?
Yeah, that was the most worrisome part of many missions. Loaded with fuel and bombs, you just hoped that the bird would fly. And forming up was a slow process. We couldn't gain altitude very fast, even at full power. You just gained inches at a time, it seemed. So we would circle or fly an oblong pattern, gradually pulling up into formation with the planes ahead of us and those coming up behind us into elements and then into a squadron. And then we would move to the point where squadrons formed into groups and the groups into a wing. All of this while just circling and gradually gaining altitude and before heading over the Adriatic north to southern Europe. So we climbed all the way to the target, and that was, what, a 5-hour flight, barely gaining altitude. hoping to get to 32 or 35,000 feet by the time we reached the initial point of the bomb run. There was little opposition on the way, no flak, no fighters. But once we got close to the target, the action began. It was mostly flak, seldom saw fighters. And then on the bomb run, from the initial point of the bomb run to the target, was the fearsome part. Totally, the sky was just covered with exploding anti-aircraft shells.
And there's no evasive action that you can do. You just have to plow straight ahead.
From that point, from the initial point to the target, the bomb run is straight and level and no evasive action.
If you get hit, you get hit.
Yeah.
And what did it feel like when you did?
Well, we had bursts that were close enough that we could tell that it jarred the airplane. Mm-hmm. And then we could also sometimes hear pings as flak cut through the metal of the fuselage of the plane. Fortunately, none of the original crew that I went over with were hit, except the navigator who got a piece of flak through his hand on one mission, which I wasn't on.
Which I'm
but
sure
there
you're
were
thankful.
Lots of other casualties.
Mm-hmm. Did you have an underlying fear that you could be hit, that you could be wounded or even killed?
There were times when this flak got close that, we thought maybe this is it.
And what do you do with that? How do you process that?
You just keep doing your job and know that it's going to be over in a few minutes.
One way or the other.
Yeah.
Now, I mentioned the mission that you remember as being your closest call of the 22 that you flew before the war came to an end there in Europe. This involved the Alps, which you have some great pictures of flying over the Alps, and it involved losing an engine. What happened? What do you remember about that?
Well, we lost an engine over the target after dropping our bombs, and we dropped out of formation. Once we had left the target area, we felt safe leaving the formation because we didn't think that the chances were very high that we'd be singled out for attack. So we were flying back alone. Coming home from a mission in Germany or Austria, the Alps was always a hurdle. Because if you didn't have enough altitude to clear the Alps, you crash-landed somewhere in enemy territory. So we sweated that out, cleared the Alps with a couple thousand feet of altitude, actually. But we're still losing altitude as we approached the Adriatic Sea and debated whether to try to fly home or take an alternative, which was offered to us. The British Army had secured an island in the Dalmatian Islands off the coast of Yugoslavia. One island had not been taken by the Germans, and the British had secured it and built an airstrip on it. That was a last resort. If we couldn't make it across the Adriatic, we could land there. So as we approached the coast, we decided that we would take that option. The island was Vis, which if you look at a map of the Adriatic, is the furthest out of the large islands along the coast of Yugoslavia. Flying alone, we had already left the formation. We decided to take refuge in that airstrip. It turned out as we got down to the island and could see it, the airstrip was very short and had a mountain at each end. For a four-engine plane, it meant slipping in there over one mountain and rolling to a halt before reaching the end of the airstrip in the other mountain.
In other words, it's going to take a pretty good amount of skill from the pilot to pull this off.
It did, right. But I was flying with a pilot that I had confidence in. The whole crew was feeling confident. We made it without any trouble, actually. But the plane, we lost one landing gear on the landing. And it spun out and crashed and was not flyable. So I don't know if it ever came home. It's probably still on that island. And the next day, we spent the night there. This was a transition point between the Allies and the partisans of Yugoslavia, the Tito Underground Army. And we heard that Tito himself came over to the island frequently. In fact, had been there just a day before we got there. But we met with and mingled with the partisan fighters, and they were certainly a rough crew of people. They all wore red stars on their helmets, on their caps. They didn't have much in the way of uniforms. But it was an interesting overnight. And the next day, a British shuttle came over, picked us up, and took us back home to our home field.
Which I'm sure was a relief. And I'm curious, as you guys are coming in for that landing, and here you are, you're not flying the plane, but you're sitting right next to the guy who is. You can see everything that's happening. You can hear everything that's happening. You know how dicey a situation this is. If you can take us back there, what do you remember? What was going through your mind? What did that feel like to not know if this was going to work out or not?
Well, it took both of us to land the plane. There was a lot to do.
I thought you were giving him all the credit.
No.
Well, let's hear it.
I do give him the credit. He flew the plane in, but there was a lot of work in the cockpit that had to be done by both of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were watching instruments and changing controls constantly on the approach. We did a pretty good job getting it down.
I imagine that you had to drop fairly quickly to get beyond the hill.
Right. Drop over one mountain and right onto the airstrip.
Is that one of those where your stomach rises up into your Adam's apple?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was probably the most interesting landing I ever had in a B-17.
And you said one of the landing gears was damaged, so I imagine you didn't come down
failed.
Exactly smooth, huh?
Right. We rode down the runway straight for halfway, perhaps, and then it just skidded off to the right and spun out.
Was that a big sigh of relief? A lot of exhaling?
The plane was pretty damaged. Our first fear was fire, so we just evacuated the plane and got as far away from it as we could.
You know, because I think people listening, they might be hearing you describe this, and it sounds like no big deal. You lived through it. They didn't. I think most people would be freaking out a little bit in that situation.
Yeah. Lots of forced landings similar to this were made in B-17s all throughout the war, either in combat or even in training flights.
Mm-hmm. Having made it through that, did that change your perspective at all?
No, as a matter of fact, I think I've been back on another mission in two or three days.
You know, people go through something like that, and sometimes they say, wow, that was horrible. How bad is the next one going to be? And then other people say, wow, if we can make it through that, we can make it through anything. Where were you on that spectrum?
Well, I guess we looked at each mission as an entity of its by itself. Whatever happened on one mission could be totally different on another.
And I know this is a tough question, tough to answer. If you could put into words how close you think you guys were to not surviving that landing, I mean, what was the margin for error there?
That forced landing was not nearly as important as some of the events in combat, the times over the target when flak was heavy and planes were falling out of formation on all sides of us.
So what I, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but reading between the lines here, I think I hear you saying, while you know there are other crews that went through worse things than you guys did, you feel pretty fortunate to have survived everything you went through.
I was very fortunate in everything that I encountered throughout the war, yeah.
And is it fair to say that when you found out this war in Europe was over, that was a good day for you?
We saw it coming. It wasn't just an unexpected event. Our missions, our work in strategic bombing tapered off in the last month of the war. Fewer missions were flown. Different types of missions were flown. We felt the war ending at least over a month's time.
So when that finally happened, when it was official and you got that word, what was it like at your base? What was the celebration like?
Well, the celebrating went on as usual. We celebrated every day we were able to fly.
Mm-hmm.
But we all were wondering what was going to happen to us, whether we'd be sent home. There were rumors that we would be sent home, trained in the new bomber.
The B-29?
The 29.
Uh-huh. And
sent over to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that was the plan if the war over there hadn't ended so suddenly after the Hiroshima bombing. Or whether we would be stuck there in Europe until sometime in the future, whether we'd be moved to another theater, possibly go home, stay in occupation, or whatever.
How long was it for you until you got to come back to
the
States?
Actually, I had a misfortune. Just a week or so after the VE Day, I got word through the Red Cross that my mother had died.
Mm.
And so the chaplain came to me and said, "Do you want to go home?" And I had to think about that. I didn't really want to leave my comrades who spent so much time with, but I knew I had an obligation to get home. So I left the squadron and was flown home in a ferry command ship.
And I imagine, I mean, obviously that had to be difficult for you, but I would imagine that all this time you'd been overseas flying these missions, that you have a purpose in mind, that you're doing this not just for yourself, but for your country, obviously. And I imagine you often thought of your family, that your mother was one of the people you were out there representing. Am I putting too much into that?
Perhaps.
Yeah?
I didn't give much thought to people back home. The immediate presence, being with the people that I'd come to think of as family, was the crew and the fellow crews in our squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd hoped to maintain relations with them, but because I left so suddenly, I lost contact with all of them.
Did you ever reestablish contact with any of them?
Not with any of them. I tried sometimes, a few times after the war, with no success.
So you're not sure if any of them are still around or not, probably?
No, I really don't know.
Huh. Well, maybe we can help you find some of that out if you're still interested. And I know one thing you were interested in when you did come home. I mentioned you had met a special lady in Tennessee a month before shipping over. You exchanged letters with her throughout this time.
Yeah.
I bet you're in a hurry to track her down.
Well, yes, I was, and it worked out. She was a Tennessee girl, but she had family, an adopted family that were in the service. Her foster father was a chaplain who happened to be stationed at Letterman Hospital in San Francisco in the summertime when I came home, and he had invited her out to stay with them and work in the financial district at the Bank of America in San Francisco, and that's where she was. So I flew up there, and we got together.
And stayed together.
And stayed together, yeah.
Since that time, you've had a daughter, you have a grandson, a couple people who wouldn't be around if you hadn't made it through World War II. And how is it that Fresno State came to claim you as one of its professors?
I got a master's degree in English at Berkeley, and the GI Bill ran out at about the same time, so I had to go to work, and I didn't know what else to do but get a teaching credential, and I got a job, high school teaching down here in the Valley, and took classes at Fresno State, and when an opening developed in the history department, they invited me in if I would go back and get my doctorate. So after thinking that over a long time, we decided we'd make the sacrifice. And my wife put me through graduate school at Stanford, and I got a degree there.
Mm-hmm. And taught 21 years at Fresno State.
Well, taking classes at Fresno State while teaching high school, and then I developed a relationship with faculty in the history department. They invited me in if I would get the terminal degree.
In all those years, these students are taking history classes, and it strikes me now that I wonder if they knew the kind of history that the instructor had lived. Did you ever bring any of those World War II experiences into any of your lectures?
I don't think so. It wouldn't have been relevant.
You were teaching earlier time periods?
Yeah, I was teaching European history, ancient history.
Mm-hmm. Well, and these days, people younger than I and a lot of people my age would think of World War II as ancient history. Not for you. You lived it. So put on your professor hat again and tell us, if you can, why you think it's important for us now to remember World War II, to know what happened, and to not let that history be forgotten. Why do you think that's important today?
Well, you're doing a wonderful job of preserving history. Oral history is a new development in academia.
Mm-hmm.
And to think that we have lost all of the stories of previous times because we had no recording facilities. Just a huge loss to history. Today, people like you who are recording reminiscences and the stories of the people who went through recent history are doing a great service to the future.
Well, you know, the school where he used to teach, Fresno State, is doing a real good job of oral histories, too, with some of our veterans. We're going to talk about that in the weeks ahead. What do you think is most important for us to know, those of us who didn't live through World War II? What would you tell us about your generation? What makes you most proud to have been a World War II veteran and to have helped win that war?
Have you ever read The Greatest Generation? Tom Brokaw?
Tom Brokaw. Sure.
That tells it all, I think. And I was right in the middle of that generation. And having read that book, it brings home how important oral history is, talking and preserving the stories of the people that lived the Depression and the Great War.
Is there something you think about that generation, something that you think we could learn from today and try to recapture here in America?
It's amazing how relevant the period of the Great Depression is to our economic troubles today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if people had a better memory of that time, how people coped, how we climbed out of that depression, it would serve to perhaps reaching better policies.
You know, if there's anything else about your time in the service that you want to share, I want to give you that opportunity. And above and beyond that, the one more question that's on my mind, I like to ask everybody what their secret is. People that have been married for 60 or 70 years, I ask them, what's the secret to a long-lasting marriage? And I'm going to clue our audience in, you walked to this interview today from several blocks away. You walk 4 to 5 miles a day at age 90. You're in terrific shape for someone your age. And you probably don't like me saying someone your age at the end of that sentence. But what is your secret and what keeps you so young?
90% of it is probably luck. Luck of the genes, I suppose. I have so many colleagues that I've lost to health problems of all kinds. Many who are living but barely living and poor health. So I have to attribute it mostly to luck.
For quite a while now, you have been a volunteer docent at the wonderful zoo we have here in Fresno, the Chaffee Zoo. Why do you do that? At age 90, you keep going down there and giving school kids and adults alike tours and educational experiences there. Where does that come from?
Well, I've been doing volunteer work ever since I retired, almost 30 years ago. I ran out of jobs at the university. The last volunteer job I had there was on the Outstanding Thesis Committee, where we read the top theses for master's degrees and selected the Outstanding of the Year.
Mm-hmm.
So then I looked around for other interesting prospects for volunteering and ran across people that were docents at the zoo. Found out that by taking a refresher course in zoology, I could qualify as a docent, and I've enjoyed it very much, both meeting the people that visit the zoo and working with the animals, and it's been a real different kind of experience from anything in my previous career.
I have to say, my most recent zoo visit a couple weeks ago was probably the best zoo experience I've had there ever. It's absolutely tremendous, but I'm curious for you, someone who's been volunteering there for so long, do you have a favorite animal or exhibit at the Chaffee Zoo?
Well, of course it has to be. I was most fond of the seals and sea lions way back when I first started, and they were in the old limited enclosure, which is now...
That's where the otters are going to be here soon, I guess.
That's where the otters are going to be, yeah. And now with the new...
Sea Lion Cove?
Sea Lion Cove, it's just got to be one of the spectacular zoo exhibits in California.
Absolutely. And you get to tell that story to folks. So I guess now people, forget about your old students. People can look forward to learning from you at the Fresno Chaffee Zoo. I just want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us some of your stories. Is there anything else that you think we ought to know?
No, it'd be presumptuous of me to use my experience to try to advise anybody about living in this age.
Well, I don't know. You might find a few people that would argue with you. But, Jim, again, thank you. That is Jim Eccles, 90 years old, of Fresno, California. If you want to see what he looks like, go to kmjnow.com. You'll find some of those great pictures he took during World War II as well. And we'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.